So the third lesson that we can learn from past recessions is about the bounce back.
Bounce back?
Bounce back, the recovery. So some of you may have heard the phrase, millionaires are made in recessions. And depending on what's happening in your life, when you hear that, it can either feel like gaslighting because it just seems like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Or it can feel like an opportunity. Both can be true at the same time. There are probably two people listening to this podcast right now that have very different reactions to that phrase. The phrase doesn't exist as a way to diminish what's lost during the tough times, but it's super important to call out that recessions aren't experienced by everyone the exact same way.
Yeah.
Right? There are businesses that thrive during recessions because their competitors get shuttered or they start pulling back on marketing or growth objectives. And there are individuals that thrive during recessions simply because they're able to buy low and sell high with whatever asset they're talking about. This recession, whatever it's going to be, is going to be experienced differently based on where you are. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. And today's episode, we are learning from past recessions.
Yes.
Yeah. Good old R word.
Yeah.
It feels like we've been talking about this and talking around this subject for a couple of months now. I know we did a podcast episode. I do not remember what number it is. I know we were a guest on the CNN Diversifying podcast episode with Deliane. That was actually our second time on that one, and it was the same subject. I think as recession started, you know, popping up and people were thinking, oh, is that what we're in? And then as of the time of recording this particular episode, we have recently finished our book tour. We visited six cities, including our hometown of Atlanta. And it was something that kept coming up there as well. Like, it's just been really, really interesting. It's also really shown me my age, because every single time I can truly reflect back on the last time I was working in a corporate job. I just finished school and we went into the Great Recession. So I can literally speak from adult experience. But I think what's been interesting, but also kind of confusing about this one is that this is the first time I've ever experienced like a remix of the definition of the term.
It's
like, all right, I was pretty clear, or at least I thought I was clear on what it meant to be in a recession, but it was like, well, technically not. And the people who used to define it, they're not doing that anymore.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, well, are we? Are we not? Like, it's, it seems, honestly, it felt very manipulative. Like, it felt like we're in this really weird, confusing, disillusioned media moment where they were like, no, I don't want you to feel like we're in a recession. So even if we are, I'm not going to call it that. I'm going to call it something.
People want to know, like, yes or no. And the media is kind of like, maybe?
Yeah, just like,
possibly.
You tell me. What does it feel like? Is it love or lust? It was like, what?
I actually saw a stat from Google that says that searches for the term recession are at the highest level for 2022 and are right on par with searches back in 2008 and 2009 when we actually were in a recession.
That's so that's going to be a new term. And I'm willing to bet, I'm throwing it out there since we're on the cusp of conspiracy theory. It's like, search term will like, you could argue that search term influences
like
what people see, and it will be something that influences consumer price index, right? Like what people are thinking, what they're searching for. And well, I know there's a technologist listening who's like, duh, like that's, we've been doing that for the last 10 years. So who knows?
So the economy is admittedly in a weird place, but let's back the bus up a little bit and add some context. If you've been following financial news, then you know that several experts have been predicting that the U.S. would hit a recession soon for the last few months, really.
Yeah.
And based on, and this was based on some leading indicators like, you know, a bear stock market or a stock market that's at least down 20%, which is the definition of a bear market. Well, here's what happened in the last couple of months. At the end of July, GDP numbers came in for Q2 and they weren't great.
As expected.
So, yeah, as expected. So basically the GDP numbers show that the U.S. economy shrunk for a second quarter in a row. And that is the commonly accepted definition of a recession. But surprisingly, or not surprisingly, given everything else we got going on, there's been this debate between economists, financial analysts, and of course, politicians about whether this is a real recession, because the GDP numbers, the U.S. economy numbers, don't tell the whole story.
Yep.
So, for example, When the Fed raised the interest rates, we saw inflation cool down, especially in areas like gas prices, which would indicate that, okay, that worked. There are also questions about how reliable the Q1 GDP numbers were because of the U.S.'s reaction to supply chain challenges, meaning we imported a lot of stuff, which threw off the GDP numbers. So to say we're down two quarters in a row, it's kind of like, yeah, but, right? It's a lot of back and forth. And then we're also seeing companies with solid profit margins, right? Typically in recessions, companies lose money. That's not the case here. The S&P 500 company earnings have increased by 8.1% over the last year, and 78% of companies still beat their earning expectations.
Yeah, it's really confusing, and it really makes me grateful for like business education and finance education, because I do remember a time in my life when I would not have understood anything that you just said. It was just jibber jabber, and you turn on the news and it was like, that's when you go get a snack. Like, yeah. I have no idea what this is. I'm not investing, so it doesn't really mean anything to me. And so I can totally empathize with people who see these things and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. You don't know what to react to. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to think.
You
don't
know if this is a crisis or not. Yeah. I don't want to think.
Yeah, it's right.
Tell me.
But they won't do that.
Yeah.
Because they've got time to fill and they've got to talk about it. So yeah, it's been really confusing. And typically in the process of communicating a recession or really any sort of economic health indicator, people typically run straight to unemployment. That tends to be one of the largest indicators.
Yeah.
And it was just as confusing, right?
Yeah.
So typically a recession is associated with spikes in unemployment. You talk about companies missing their earnings, and as a result, they start to cut back. Maybe consumers aren't as willing to buy their products or the services anymore. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things tend to contribute or lead to layoffs. And according to the latest jobs report, the U.S. economy added 528,000 jobs in July of 2022, which means we've regained all the jobs that we lost in the pandemic and made unemployment rates drop down back to 3.5%, which was basically pre-pandemic levels, which is just confusing because you would think, again, you don't even have to be the smartest person in the room, but you would think markets are down, people are missing their earnings. We have seen some layoffs, but there's kind of hesitant and
in
hedging.
Tech, there is for sure.
Correct.
Some sort of recession happening,
right?
Like, if you're in the tech sector, this episode really isn't applicable to you because y'all deserve your own episode when you are experiencing layoffs, down profits, you know, not hitting your revenue expectations, all that jazz.
Yeah. And we've seen some rebounding there as well. So it's been a really big missed bag. I don't think we're really going to get into like real estate because that is its own category and one of those other heavy indicators. I think we're starting to see cooling from that as well. I think, you know, I don't want to jump all the way to like final thoughts, but I think it's safe to say, and I feel like this is a bit of like a classic economic theory, but you kind of have to treat each recession like it's its own thing.
Yes.
Right? And I think that's one of the early lessons that even I'm learning is that, wow, like every recession is not going to look and feel like 2008.
Correct.
It's certainly not going to feel like some of the smaller ones we felt. And this one, if we're even in one, is just going to be different. But either way, the good news is a lot of the fundamental practices around money sort of tend to stand the test of time. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of those things in this episode.
I just, in times like this where the answer is maybe or gray area or somewhat subjective, I just always find it comforting to focus on what we know.
Yeah.
And what we know is that recessions, downturns, whatever you want to call them, one, are normal and natural. Two, that they've happened before. And three, that they will happen again. Even if it's not in Q3 of 2022, we know that things haven't completely cycled out yet. We're still experiencing the effects of a pandemic with new strains and new viruses. We got labor challenges in very key sectors like healthcare and childcare, both of which impact people's ability to contribute to the economy and work. And there's still a war in Ukraine, among other things.
Like, it's still happening. I know it's sort of slipped out of the major news cycle, but that's still alive.
Yeah, it's still very much a thing.
Kicking. Yeah.
Yeah. So for today's episode, like Julia mentioned, we figured we'd pull out a few evergreen lessons from previous recessions that are applicable, really, whether there's a recession or not.
Yep. All right. So let's dig in. Let's start with some fun facts or not so fun facts, given the nature of the topic. There have been roughly 17 recessions in the last 100 years.
Wow.
The average duration of a recession is around 17 months. But the shortest one was the one that we went through.
The one that we just went through. I know. You don't even remember.
Forgettable recession. Yeah. I call
lasted
me traditional. I'm like, that's not a recession. It was like a one night. Stand
it was
recession.
A recession, according to the old definition.
Early 2020, it felt more like a hiccup. It was like pandemic.
Well, that's
stop
why they
everything.
Changed the definition, because you calling it a hiccup,
okay.
And they wanted you to feel like it was
I
a
didn't
recession.
Feel that recession.
It was only 2 months long.
Right.
That's why it's the record for the shortest.
All right. Well, so on the other side of that, the longest recession we had was 5 years. That was back in the 1800s. No one that's listening to this was alive or probably even cares. But I think if you're looking for a good rule of thumb, it's typically, you can expect a recession to last about a year or two. So anywhere from 12 to 24 months. Knowing what we know about the duration of recessions, the first lesson is not to overreact to volatility. Again, you talk about, you know, these 2 months stint, especially in those situations. I can't imagine how many people may have overreacted, which, again, you know, justifiably. I mean, it was a pandemic, which seems like a once-in-a-lifetime event.
Yeah.
You want to pull your money out because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But again, just sort of with the gift of sort of foresight and looking back, we can share some of these tips to say, hey, do not overreact to what we're in, especially if what we're experiencing is going to be within a typical 1 to 2 year time period.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that overreacting just exacerbates the issue. So for better or worse, doesn't really matter. Our economy is driven by consumers, people buying and selling things on a regular basis. And when consumers lose confidence, they freak out. That leads to them spending less. Then companies make less money and they let people go. And it just spirals into this endless loop. You think back to 2020 and the whole scare around toilet paper and people really feeling like, oh my gosh, and there's no bread on the shelves and rice and all those things. Like, we, all of us play a role in whether or not we want to kind of keep this thing together or not. So not overreacting is key. Do your part and trust that your neighbors and your neighbor's neighbors will do their part. The second thing is panic selling and buying is never a good idea. And I don't care what it is.
Right.
You're selling a product, your home, your stocks or mutual funds. Panic selling and buying is never a good idea. Once you add emotions to the mix, they really sort of skew with your ability to process data or evidence or sort of factor in any type of substantial information that you really should be relying on. So whether it's you're liquidating your 401ks or signing up for a 0% interest card to buy stocks with, which we know people did because they felt like it was a fire sale. Like, all of these things are sort of being fueled by, for better or worse, good or bad feelings. And they're highly irrational.
Yes.
Not to say that they never work out. For some people, they do. But for the vast majority of people, it is just really, really risky. And so if you're one of those people who aren't dabbling in those things and one of those, I'm using air quotes here, opportunities present themselves to you, just take a deep breath, relax, focus on what you're doing for the long run, which is the vast majority of us, and I think you will be fine. I think that's especially true for people in the housing market because even if you can sell your house at a peak or if you're trying not to repeat what you may have experienced in 2008, the next question you've got to ask is, all right, but where are you going to live? And if you're not going to move to a lower cost of living area or something like that, then you're most likely not going to reap any of the benefit from actually selling.
There's a lot of people who panic bought homes. We did a episode on that. And now that the market is softening, they realize that oh man, I should have waited.
Yeah.
I just find that the biggest hedge against kind of investor overreaction is really to refocus all that energy on the financial fundamentals.
Yeah.
So build an emergency fund and prioritize replenishing it when/if there is an emergency. I know that I've talked to several people in the last couple of weeks on our book tour, and they were in the process of rebuilding their emergency fund or replenishing it due to car troubles, home maintenance, family support, you name it. And I don't want to minimize how difficult it can be to set aside extra money during these hyperinflationary times. But building that muscle of paying yourself first is so important because of these times. It's what allows you to kind of get through these times without being completely devastated or destroyed by them.
I will take that a step further and say it's one of the things that gives you that extra boost of confidence to invest or to invest more.
Yeah.
Because you know you've got that security blanket underneath you. So I would not underestimate the value of reevaluating an emergency fund, funding it, and sort of using that as your sort of badge of courage in these confusing times.
Yeah. The next financial fundamental I'd focus on is a budget. You need a budget, baby, like one that keeps you engaged with the comings and goings of your dollars on a regular basis. Now, we haven't been traditional budgeters for a long time, but in response to this clinical definition of a recession and in preparation for like a real kind of air quotes recession, I don't even know how to describe the time.
It's a recession. We're just going to call it a recession.
A recession-ish.
Not a real recession.
I don't know.
Baby recession.
Point is, I've reached back into my budgeting bag and I was telling Julian about this earlier, I was starting to look and experiment in the fintech space to see what's changed from the days of Mint and Personal Capital and me just using my pen and paper to see if there's something that would work for us. So I encourage you, if you have a budget that you haven't looked at, or you're kind of on autopilot, or you've gotten to the point where it's not a huge part of your day or your week, whatever it is, just take another look. Just make sure that you understand where your dollars are coming from and where they're going.
Yeah, I look forward to whenever that family meeting is so we can look at whatever new tool that you have signed us up for. Okay, so second lesson, and man, my heart just sort of dips just even just thinking about or getting ready to say this, but it's really around calculating the ROI of upskilling. And upskilling is, a term that I think we did an entire episode about that. Mm-hmm. But what you normally see is during these times, people, start seeing layoffs or hearing about layoffs, and they tend to view it as downtime in a way, or like an opportunity to learn new skills since no one's hiring. And so people say, well, now's the perfect time to go back to school. And you start to see people reevaluating or rejigging their resumes and taking certification programs or going back to school so that they can be more competitive and then get back out there. I kind of think of that the same way as I do people who are trying to time the stock market in a way.
Right.
But while there's nothing wrong, I'm not, against people wanting to learn more or learn new skills, I do think we need to do a better job of identifying job prospects or income earning potential before making the commitment to going back to school. So switching gears for a little bit and talking about the student loan debt crisis, a good bit of that debt came from people who attended some of these smaller
vocational schools.
Mm-hmm. That believed that they'd be able to get out there and earn more money, only to realize that there literally were not any jobs, or compared to the number of applicants and graduates from these programs, there just weren't enough jobs to go around. And I always think about that commercial with the dude who's walking in a parking lot. I think it was for Everest College. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what are you doing? You're sitting on your couch. You're not doing anything. You're wasting your life away. Come on down, Everest College. It ran for years, and it became comedy fodder and all those things. But it was basically for a program or school that offered programs for people who wanted to be medical assistants or office managers or dental assistants and so on. And it was a part of a larger system of what I like to think of as pop-up adult education programs. Long story short, they ultimately were sued for making deceptive statements. They were basically telling people, you spend thousands of dollars, come with us, and then you can leave here and you can make some really great money doing these things. And after, sort of the faulty claims started to pile up, people took that to the next level and started suing them. And that company actually ended up losing accreditation. They're the poster child for the student loan debt crisis. Corinthian College, I think, was a part of that as well. So again, if you were caught up in that, I'm so, so sorry. But one thing that we know sort of comes with a recession are these types of things pop up, different face, different name. They're going to come back if they haven't already. So that's something to be mindful of. But if you're one of those people who went to, let's say, a traditional 4-year college, or maybe even got a graduate degree, and you're thinking, well, that's not for me. Those are for people who, let's say, didn't go to college. Well, guess what? Like, there are also executive MBA programs. Oh. You might even be in one. I know I have family members who've been in them. And I'm not saying they're the same. But again, going back to the point here, we need to do a better job of calculating what the ROI is of these programs. So, for example, I happened to look it up. And Wharton, which is one of the top schools in the world, obviously this is a bit extreme, but the average cost to get an executive MBA at the University of, what is Wharton? Is it Chicago?
Penn.
Chicago, is $196,000 for an executive MBA program. And I saw that number and I was like, my Lord, like that is a lot of money. I looked up Georgia Tech just to give some comparison, right? So we're not necessarily in the Ivy League anymore, but Georgia Tech, local school, still very good, very reputable. The cost of their executive program, still really pricey, $76,500, right? So I did a little bit more digging, and U.S. News did a survey, and the average executive MBA graduate received a 13.5% increase in compensation between the start and the end of their program, and about 40% of them actually received a promotion. So you can do some very simple math there, right? You're making $100,000. Let's say on average you get a 13.5% raise. It's going to take you maybe 5 or 6 years if you went to Tech to earn that money back. If you went to Wharton and you were making $100,000, good luck. Hopefully you were making more than that to help offset the payback period for that program. And again, that's in addition to any loans that you may already have or any debt that you may already have. That's in addition to any loss of income that you may be dealing with while you were going to school, assuming you went full time. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things, I just think, need to be factored into it. I get it. You may be working for a company that offers free tuition or even discounted, and you're not sort of thinking about the bigger picture here. But upskilling in a recession is, yes, generally a good idea, but finish the problem. Do the math. Figure out what you might potentially be able to move into, whether or not those jobs even exist, and then factor that into your decision before you fork up hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I was talking to a young lady yesterday at an employee event that we did in Charlotte, and she was telling me that she just transitioned to the financial industry from higher education, and I was asking her about the transition because we know so many educators that are looking to pivot out of what they're doing currently. I was asking her how difficult the transition was, and the first thing she said was, she was like, well, really it wasn't that hard because higher education is big business.
Yeah.
And so the only thing I had to learn was like the acronyms, the language, you know, what it meant over here. But there was a version of it where I left. There was a version of it in higher education. And it reminds me of this article that the New York Times, this op-ed that the New York Times published a couple of weeks ago, that talks about how some colleges just aren't good at producing people who make high earnings. Like they're not good at producing high earners for companies, but there's no methodology for holding them accountable the same way you could hold a big business accountable for not hitting any of their goals.
Yeah.
There's no like stock market for high ed that can say like, all right, I want to pull my, the only thing you can do is unenroll, withdraw, or just not go to begin with. So it's just something to think about. I think a start for consumers is really to do that ROI work, really to look up the job that you plan to have once it's done, look up, you know, reviews, look up the org charts, how big the company is, to know exactly how many of you are going to be competing for that same spot.
Yeah, it's a very romantic and mysterious world. Again, even as when I was looking it up just to see if I could find some information about like how to calculate ROI, it was just as opaque as it was when I was in college. I was like, oh, you can't even get a quote. You've got to enter your email, to download the brochure, and then somebody reach out to you. So yeah, guys, things have not changed in that regard.
Yeah.
And so it's important, obviously, to, you know, sharpen your skills. But you want to make sure that you've got or stand a good chance of getting back what you put in for any number of these certification or executive or graduate programs.
So the third lesson that we can learn from past recessions is about the bounce back.
Bounce back.
Bounce back. The recovery. So some of you may have heard the phrase, millionaires are made in recessions. And depending on what's happening in your life, when you hear that, it can either feel like gaslighting because it just seems like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Or it can feel like an opportunity. Both can be true at the same time. There are probably two people listening to this podcast right now that have very different reactions to that phrase. The phrase doesn't exist as a way to diminish what's lost during the tough times, but it's super important to call out that recessions aren't experienced by everyone the exact same way.
Yeah.
Right? There are businesses that thrive during recessions because their competitors get shuttered or they start pulling back on marketing or growth objectives. And there are individuals that thrive during recessions simply because they're able to buy low and sell high with whatever asset they're talking about. This recession, whatever it's going to be, is going to be experienced differently based on where you are.
Listen, the Great Recession, which was not called that, I don't know what they called that at the time. It was just a recession.
Yeah.
It was economic downturn.
Well, it was in 2008. That was a housing bubble.
Yeah, they was more focused on the housing market crash. Yeah.
It didn't have a cute name.
I think that came probably in 2009. I can probably look that up. But that recession or that time period fundamentally changed my life. And I think, I know so many people who started their jobs during that time period and they have these horrific memories. But for me, I did start that job, but I was also really mindful of investing. And I think that's what really helped me to look at the larger picture and to be able to look back on it as overall a really good thing. I bought my first home in 2007. By 2008, the value of that property dropped by 50%. With respect to that note, the good news was I had a traditional fixed mortgage. I did not fall into the adjustable rate mortgage crisis that so many people fell into. And so I didn't have much of an issue in terms of what I owed or needed in order to keep that home. I never missed a payment or anything like that. I also didn't have very much invested at the time. I might have had maybe $10,000, but at the time it was a lot to me. And I knew even then that I was actually more than most people. And so I felt very optimistic starting my career. And while I knew it was down, I felt like I had time on my side. I was in my 20s, and I felt like, wow, like the only thing that could really come from this really, really like steep downturn is like a great rebound. So it's like the counter to a great recession is like a great rebound.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened, right? I'm not a genius, but I just knew that, wow, like that's really what happens after this. And so I want to add some color to this or some numbers just to kind of help you guys understand this. And so when you look at one of the major economic indicators of the financial markets, obviously the Dow Jones Industrial Average is one of those things. You hear about it on the news, you hear about it in articles. And back in 2007, the Dow Jones Industrial Average peaked at 14,164 points. You don't even have to understand what that means. Just follow me for a second. It peaked and the score was 14,164. By the next year, it had just bloody day, the worst fall in the history of the stock market, I believe. And it dropped 777 points in one day, which brought it to a low of 10,300. So we went from 14,000 basically to 10,000. So you can assume we lost around 40,000, right? 40%, excuse me. So if you think about that in terms of financial terms, using, again, very similar numbers, if you had $10,000 invested in 2007, and that's when you started, you probably had closer to around $6,000 right around that time. So you would have like lost like almost half of your money, which is a really difficult pill to swallow. Obviously, if you would have sold, then you would have sort of essentially banked that loss. Now, if you'd done nothing, if you intentionally lost your password or just did nothing, like went to sleep, didn't wake up like a bear, like a legitimate bear during this market, that same $10,000 would have declined by 40% in 2008, like we said, but it would have rebounded to its original value of $10,000 by mid-2012, right? So 2 years, just like we said, a typical recession. And even better, 10 years now, here we are in 2022, that same $10,000 would have turned into almost $33,000, right? And so if you've been invested throughout that time period, you've been mindful of what you're investing in, which would happen to be the longest bull market in history from March 2008. Up until this year, you've had a really, really great run, right? Mm-hmm. Your money grew handsomely and you've been rewarded for your patience or essentially holding on. And so we've said it before and we'll say it again, stay the course, ignore the hype. You really don't have to plug into the news to figure out what the day-to-day moves are. If you're a long-term investor, you just need to hold on and best case scenario, continue to invest. And I'll take it a step further and say like these projections, this idea of tripling over that 13-year period, That's just if you took the approach of a simple total stock market index fund. If you had played a little bit more aggressively in growth sectors like tech or energy or healthcare, financial services, you probably would have like quadrupled or 5x your money, which a lot of people did.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is such an important lesson. I do not know, and I'm not going to pretend to know what's going to happen or whether or not this recession is going to be like the last one. But we do know that in general, it's a cycle.
Yeah.
So it goes down, it goes back up. To what extent, we don't know.
Yeah.
But if you hold on, and in some cases don't do anything, but just keep investing, history suggests that you're going to come out the other end with way more money than you would have had if you decided to sell.
Yeah, I think those examples are what people mean when they say millionaires are made in recessions. They mean over a 10-year period, they can look back and see that the money they've put in has 3x'd, 5x'd,
absolutely,
10x'd, whatever.
And the more they have, the more aggressive they're willing to play.
Exactly.
Right? And because they know that if they lose it, it doesn't matter. And so that's really where that phrase comes from.
Now, one precaution I'll tell people about the phrase is that it's not a blanket statement to justify just any old investment that you want to make, because again, assets fare very differently based on the reason for the recession. So going back to real estate, like you mentioned earlier, there's really no one size fits all trend line that correlates the impact of U.S. recessions on the real estate industry. Sure, the industry has boomed after our little hiccup of a 2020 recession. But if you take it back to 2008 and your story, we saw the biggest drop in home prices because that recession was fueled by a collapse in the housing market.
Yeah.
And before that, even before that, in the 2000s, after 9/11, the stock market tanked because the New York Stock Exchange had to close due to the attacks.
Yep.
But the housing market actually remained stable. In fact, home prices rose and conditions remained favorable for home buyers.
Which kind of makes sense. Like, there's not going to be a lot of, you know, sellings and closing, you know, during a moment like that. It's just like a pause. There's no real reason for values to decline. So,
right. But I think the point is these ups and downs are what it means to have a free market economy, which we do. Allegedly, at least on paper.
For now.
And I apologize in advance for the brief economics lesson, but I think this is important because in economics, a free market, I'm just going to define it for y'all real quick. A free market is one where the goods and services are self-regulated by buyers and sellers, presumably without any intervention by government or any other authority.
Yep.
Right? So we'll avoid a political science conversation about what's considered an intervention and a free market economy. But in the U.S., we have thousands of markets, maybe even hundreds of thousands of markets. The ones that we tend to focus on when we're talking about wealth building are the big ones: real estate market, stock market, financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that makes the U.S. somewhat unique is that we also have the largest consumer market in the world. When you look at our consumer spending, aka the purchases that our households make, we rank way, 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 way higher than any other country in the world. So what does that mean? It means that our political leaders have a very strong incentive to ensure that people have money to spend and businesses to spend it on, which is why the rebounds keep happening. It's why things tank, but eventually the counterbalance, the rational side of, wait, we can't let the country just fail, comes back and allows the free market to do what it needs to do.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a little confusing because it seems like there should be something else there besides just like a bunch of people moving the same way. But like, that's what it is.
Yeah. We spent a good bit of time talking about that in our book in terms of, regardless of what's happened over the years, like, it's too big to fail. Right.
Yeah.
So that's really where you want to sort of place your chips. And this is certainly one of the considerations around investing. I think the other argument here is whether or not like this is sustainable or not. And honestly, it's up to you to decide where you land in that debate.
Correct.
Like, I'm not here to convince you either way, but we are, you know, trying to convince you that if you're not prepared, the likelihood that you become collateral damage and all of these exchanges within this free market is significantly higher compared to or versus if you were prepared and can mitigate some of that risk. And so in the same way that if you ride a motorcycle on a highway without a helmet, like you're at a greater risk than someone who chooses to take the extra step and put some pads on and puts on a helmet. I think in a world where people are earning income and having their earned income then earn interest, it's very quickly. Mm-hmm. And we just sort of explained how that works. Like the combination of those two things, like once you understand that, it's very clear that the combination of those two things compared to people who aren't investing consistently really just sort of lose mm-hmm. over time. Like you can't keep up if you're mm-hmm. just trying to work your way to compete in those ways. And that has like really broad implications. So, you know, you really want to avoid this sort of inevitable crisis if you can. And a lot of that comes with, you know, looking at your risk tolerance, being consistent with respect to the way that you invest, and using the combination of all of those things to mitigate any future issues or crises that we may be experiencing in the future, hopefully far
in the future. Yeah. Amen to that. I think that's a good note to end it on. Should we move to final thoughts?
What you got?
All right. So I just want to say that the first class that I ever like truly, truly struggled with in school was my freshman year at Carolina. And the class was macroeconomics.
Oh, I loved econ.
Oh, my God. Econ I could do. Macro econ? Like macroeconomics is the branch of economics that studies how an overall economy behaves. And it was just like it was too much. And based on, you know, these Google search trends that we're seeing, there are a lot of people playing catch up and trying to learn what all this means. And I get that it can be overwhelming because it's complicated. It's so complicated and it's all made up. Yeah. And recognizing that it's hard. But even though macroeconomics is complicated, your response doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Your response can be as simple as the few practical steps that we've outlined in this episode and the 72-ish episodes that came before it. Pay yourself first. Spend less than you make. Focus on finding income streams. And if you can't find a stream, settle for a trickle. Like, just find something. And if you can invest, keep doing it. But if you can't right now, don't beat yourself up. Like, stick to the basics. Keep trucking. Keep finding the trickles. And eventually you'll have some sort of surplus that you can throw into one of these crazy markets.
Yeah. Yeah. I can keep on going for days because like it's so complex. And you're right. Like it's a very emotional thing. I am like I can't help but to keep thinking about the people that we met with. A few days ago, we met with about 50 professionals. We were brought in to do an event, and I was one surprised by how many younger people there were in the room. Mm-hmm. I kind of enjoyed that because like it was like, wow, it's really good to see us in mm-hmm. here doing well. But I will say, based on some of the conversations we had afterwards, it felt to me like there was a bit of a lax or very optimistic and lackadaisical approach. There wasn't like a sense of urgency or even like people sensed like this was a huge opportunity. And that was probably for a variety of reasons. But when you think about that and you think about, you know, things like a recession, you know, and I just try to imagine myself as a 20-year-old again and learning about some of these fundamental concepts, you just really have to remind yourself, like, one, don't overcomplicate this stuff. And two, remember that time is, without question, the greatest ingredient that you have. And so if you're in your 30s or your 40s and you're going through this time period where, you know, you did the right thing or you were doing the right thing, but something is happening in your life and you feel like this recession is a thing that's going to sort of spark you to sort of cut your losses, I want you to think of that as like a reset button. Mm-hmm. Think about the calculations that you did in your 20s where you were bright-eyed and super optimistic, mm-hmm. like the people that we just met. And if you sell right now, if you will cheat yourself out of the real magic of compounding interest, right? You don't want to do that. So have more confidence in yourself. I would say even to Kirsten's point, figure out a way to hold on, but don't let go. Just keep going. Keep investing so that you truly extract as much value over a 30 or 40 year period of having your money work for you. I think that's really, really important. And so hopefully we've done a good job of walking you away from the proverbial ledge and just calming down. And honestly, maybe do yourself like a, I don't know if like this exists in terms of like Google alerts, but it's like if something has to do with the word recession.
Just mute it.
Don't even show it to me. I need like an anti-Google alert. It's like, block anything about it and just keep going. Like, live in a world where that word doesn't exist, which technically feels like right now, because I don't know what the word means anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the lessons we called are the ones you can know. The rest of the stuff is kind of speculation, kind of like trend following, all that jazz.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. I know I couldn't answer, are we in a recession, with a yes or no answer, but you have the opportunity to answer this question with a yes or no answer. And that's, have you left us a review yet? Because if you haven't, you can head on over to the ratings and review page and leave us 5 stars. We appreciate you for listening, and we will see y'all next week.
Peace.